Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 18th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I've been in Tucson since Monday. I've spent several days with members of the Solari Network, and I just today gave a workshop at the IONS, and that stands for Institute of Noetic Sciences Conference, which is here in Tucson. So tonight I'd just like to make some comments about what I've learned here in Tucson, and then a review of the top stories in money and markets. We got some great questions and answering and Ask Catherine, so I'm gonna answer a few more than I usually do. And then a briefing on the state budget crisis in California and what it means to you. In particular, I'm going to be focused on citizens of California, but the state and local budget issues are a wave that's coming and are going to reach most of us, certainly in the United States, but probably in Canada, and so it's probably going to make its way through North America as well. Finally, a review of the comedy Welcome to Mooseport and Let's Go to the Movies, and it dovetails nicely with sort of the issues of coming to grips with what's going on locally and what we can do about it. So, Tucson, I've always loved Tucson. I love the desert. And I came in Monday and spent some time with a number of different people in the Solari Network, and it's just a reminder of how wonderful you all are. I thought I'd just give you a little sense of sort of who we are. The Solari update is list, which is the email updates that we send. It's probably about 8,000. And it consists of people who are either subscribers to the Solari Report or blog readers. About 80% of y'all are in North America, and the rest are spread out around the globe, usually in English-speaking nations, but not always. But what's remarkable about everyone just about I've met in the Solari Network is they're very positive, very intelligent, extremely curious about what's going on, and usually very action-oriented. You know, what can I do? What's the action? And what's odd about it is if you look at our blog readership, I tend to read the web stats pretty much daily, mixed in with this extraordinary group of people who I would describe as being on the pro-decentralization team, you have very heavy blog readership of the top 20 financial institutions and the top 20 defense contractors and the big government agencies, although we usually are more financial. So we get Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Fed, Treasury, more than we get the Senate or the House, although that can change. And I think you've heard me say this before. When the housing bubble burst was really going for about a year and a half, the big mystery every morning when I looked at the web stats was, who's going to be the biggest user on the blog? Is it going to be Fannie Mae or Goldman Sachs? Anyway, but so, you know, we're kind of a mix of the pro-centralization and pro-decentralization team. A lot of the people who deal with the Solari Network, Franklin Sanders or others, will always say, these are just the nicest people. And anyway, so you're an extraordinary group of people, and I am very delighted to be in cahoots with you. The IONS conference, we had a workshop today, and it was on audio seminar content for those of you who've listened to positioning your assets for growth in uncertain times. And essentially, we went through what's going on in the environment, where are the opportunities, what are the possible scenarios, and what can you do about them? And the serious discussion today kept coming back to the same one that we have talked about in all these Solari reports, and that is how long can the dollar continue to be the reserve currency? How long will it stay high? And will the transfer from a dollar reserve currency to something else come as a meltdown or what I call a slow burn, which is a much more managed process? And the discussion varied all over the place. You had people who were absolutely adamant that we were going to have an implosion scenario, very chaotic this year. And others were more convinced that the slow burn was going to be with us for a while. So it was a great discussion. And what I have tried to stress, what I stress today, and I keep stressing, is you know, really whether it's meltdown or slow burn has a lot to do with whether it's fast or slow. But if you work out what we can do and the actions we can take in both scenarios, in fact, a lot of the best things to do for, you know, work in either scenario. So I always like to have a plan for the worst case. So increasingly, for the last couple of years, I've tried to figure out, okay, if there's a meltdown, what do I do and how do I do it? But I do it in a way that's a sound investment of my time and energy for the slow burn. And I try not to fret because changing and changing the way we use our time and our money is a journey. It's a transformation, and it's a lifelong journey. So I try not to fret. If the meltdown comes tomorrow, will I be prepared? Probably not, but certainly more prepared than I was 10 years ago. One of the discussions that came up today is a discussion that has come into me by email and telephone a lot in the last week, and that is reports of banks not lending, and banks not lending to strong small businesses who have good cash flows, profitable businesses, good credits, good collateral, and the banks just saying, we're pulling your lines or we won't make a loan, or we'll only make a loan if you have 100% cash collateral, which of course makes it almost ridiculous to get the loan. And that fits very much with what I talked about last week with the quote from Tom O'Brien, who said that now that the banks are flush with cash, they're going to come in and take advantage of distressed assets. And of course, if banks don't lend, then you're going to see a greater slowdown in the economy. To a certain extent, if we increase the money supply, which is very inflationary, one of the things the banks can do is to slow down the lending in a way that has a deflationary effect that helps to offset the inflation. And it's back to the slow burns. The insiders use the resources to protect themselves, and then the outsiders get hurt, and the fall in income and the fall in the value of labor of the outsiders helps offset the inflation and other effects of what the insiders are doing. That's part of how the slow burns works. Okay, money and markets. My theme for this week is lockdown or breakdown. We saw a dazzling surge of action and legislation by Washington to really control a much greater portion of the economy, both the financial system and the food system. I put up an alert on the blog about a food safety bill moving through Congress. The Weston Price Foundation put out an alert about it. We're watching that legislation is designed to create far more control and make things much more difficult for small farmers. So what you're watching is a real push to kind of lock down and control the food system. We saw more discussion and debate about health care. It's very early and very fluid, so it's hard to say anything, but all indications are you're going to see far more central control of the health care system, and the health care system is pretty centrally controlled already. And then finally, from the Solari point of view, the most important, we saw the administration announce their proposal for increased financial regulation. And what you see, there was an op-ed piece in the Washington Post on Monday by both the Treasury Secretary and the National Economic Council Director, Geithner and Summers, and it outlines sort of the performance goals of this regulatory package, and I just wanted to go through them. One, it wanted to prevent banks from overlending. If you go back and look at the tremendous ease in credit during the 1990s, that ease in credit was a real joint policy by the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and the banks, with the full support of Congress, and all the sort of regulatory bodies with some rare exceptions. And so the notion that more government control is going to prevent the banks from overlending does not address what the problem was. essentially the problem was not that the banks were overlending and the government couldn't have prevented it or the Fed couldn't have prevented it. You know, it's just not true. So the need to prevent the bank from overlending, if anything, right now we have banks underlending. So, you know, sort of bogus. Number two, put the Federal Reserve in charge of overseeing financial institutions whose collapse could threaten the entire system. Now, the devil's in the details on this, but we know from all of our conversations to date that a lot of what happened is as a result of having a system which is really comprised of private banks having too much power and having a financial sector that has great power over the political process has not been working. So the idea that you're going to give the Federal Reserve more power is contradictory to real solutions. Increase reporting and transparency to give investors more information about complicated financial products sounds great. You know, a lot of times these reforms sound great, but the devil's in the details. If you look at the transparency system for mortgage-backed securities or many of these financial products, the laws were all in place to ensure whatever we needed in terms of reporting and transparency. And the fact that those laws weren't enforced was not because we needed more regulatory or legal powers. The reason they weren't enforced was, in fact, the enforcement bureaucracy was used to drive out people such as myself and my colleagues, who were working to provide that reporting and transparency. And the reality is the financial system was deeply dependent on mortgage fraud and not having that transparency. And unless you address that fundamental problem, you're going to end up with these laws and regulations or increased laws and regulations only helping that bureaucracy stifle and control the honest players and the little guys. Fourth item is regulate derivatives. Clearly, we need either some derivatives to be outlawed or we certainly need regulation of derivatives. The devil is going to be in the detail on that one again. Offer a stronger framework for consumer and investor protection across the board. You almost don't know what to say when you read this. We're talking about an administration and a Congress that cannot agree to cap credit card interest rates at even a usury rate of interest. So as we've seen, the notion that this group is going to come up with consumer investor protection that's meaningful, again, doesn't address the fundamental issue, which is what's the problem? A stronger framework for consumer investor protection, the devil's in the detail, but, you know, my attitude is let's first stop 36% interest rate on credit cards. You know, then I'll take you seriously. Six says give the government the power to wind down non-bank financial institutions in a crisis. Again, the devil's going to be in the details. In theory, we saw reports around the Internet that basically the administration was asserting the power to basically seize anybody they wanted. This is a power that, given the current construct, could be hugely abused, and so the fears are real. Finally, lead the effort to improve regulation and supervision around the world. Hard to know what that means, but what we are going to watch is a process of steadily shifting to regulatory authority, powers, and controls at the level of the IMS and the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS. And as you know from some of my earlier Soleri reports, what I'm most concerned about is over the next year or two, we're going to start seeing the Congress say, listen, we have to do this bad thing or that bad thing because the IMF has told us. So whether or not this means we're going to start to shift regulation and supervision to international authorities, or the United States is going to try and assert regulatory and supervision, it's hard to say. What's going to be interesting is we have enormous numbers of financial regulatory authorities who are going to be competing for power and control as the financial system goes through its current period of shrinkage. So it's going to be very interesting. Now, one of the things that happens in Washington when you start proposing change, particularly change to regulatory bureaucracies that could impact what are the powers of the Commodity Future and Trade Commission, what are the powers of the SEC, what are the powers of the Fed versus the FDIC, is everybody stops working and starts fighting and starts protecting their turf. And then all the industries run into Congress, into the House and Senate, and start lobbying and competing, and you really get this amazing gridlock. It's kind of like it starts a huge war. And so it's going to be very interesting what impact this has on the financial bureaucracy and the Congress and the Senate, because here you have this large group of people, and it's their job to deal with the financial crisis. And instead of having their time available for the financial crisis, they're going to be dealing with the reinvention of everything, which is a huge legal, legislative, and regulatory job in terms of hours and times that it takes. So if I wanted to gridlock all the players in the financial world in Washington and certainly send all the financial industry in giving lots more political contributions, I couldn't think of a better way to do it. So the politics of this are going to be very interesting, particularly as we come into the summer with the economy in sort of a worse and worse shape. So is this lockdown or breakdown? I'm not sure. What was interesting was when I first read the reports were published and I first started to look at it, in a certain sense, it was so ridiculous. I think many of you have heard me say that I refer to the Patriot Act as the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act, because so much of the Patriot Act helped the large financial institutions and the Fed and the New York Fed and the Treasury assert far more control of the financial system, thus shifting far more deposits, investments back into the large players. Think of it, I always use the analogy of a body, a human body, and the blood flows through the body. And when there's stress, when there's sickness or disease, the body will hoard the blood and shoot it to the most precious organs. So it will draw money away from the toes and the fingers and move it towards the brain, the heart, and the lungs. And literally what we're seeing is a financial system that is continually passing more laws and rules, and those rules enable you to basically pull blood away from the heart, the lungs, and the brain and move it toward the toes. And this is part of the centralization process where we're using laws and regulation and force to force capital into the financial centers instead of letting it be free to go where it would go just based on economic performance. Part of that happens by giving the federal credit, giving bailouts, giving all sorts of things to ensure that your economics work. But part of it is simply just force. And the danger of this proposal, just like the danger of the Paulson proposal that came at the end of the last administration, is we're looking at an economy where the Federal Reserve and the Treasury says, we want to be able to determine through political and governmental mechanisms what the cost of capital is for large players versus small players. We want to control who gets capital and how. And this is a remarkably Soviet system hidden behind layer after layer of financial regulation and financial expense that makes it very dangerous and expensive for the small players versus the large players. So let's see how it comes out. But there's an extraordinary at this point, there's an extraordinary inability, I think, on many of our parts to really take the system seriously, this is more about the control and concentration of cash, and it's not about any kind of serious reform of the system. There was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this week about, I think they used the word devolution, but it described the different sort of localization and secession movements going on everywhere from Vermont to the South, and talked a lot more about the possibility of a breakup of the country into different regional or local parts. And it was stunning to see it in the Wall Street Journal, because you would have thought, I would have sort of expected that story next year, not this year. But there is no doubt that one of the things they're picking up on is the fact that the economics are profound in terms of increased localization, and the need, given this sort of centralization, to try and make much more economic rationalization happening at the local level. Another story we touched on last week, but tremendous comments on the blog this week, is we had two Japanese couriers stopped at the Italian border. Their suitcases were gone through. There were false bottoms in the suitcases, and what was found was $134.5 billion of U.S. treasuries. Big debate all over the financial part of the internet. Were these counterfeit or real? I posted a post called "The Missing Money" on the blog to point out that if you look at what's been going on in the federal credit and the $4 trillion missing from the federal government at the end of the Clinton administration, that can't happen without significant off-balance sheet issuance of Treasury securities and sort of fraudulent securities or securities certainly that are not transparent. And so one of my points was that these kinds of things can happen. What's happened is we've got a huge amount of comments, a great discussion going on about which is more important. Should you focus on what's going on in your state and local government, or read another sort of story of what's going on in the global financial system. I do think this story is relevant for, among other things, it gives you a sense of how literally weird and fractious the system has become, because you now have the Italian government, if these securities are real, in a position to seize $40 billion of U.S. treasuries, and certainly they'll have a balanced budget this year. But it reminds you of how much paper there is floating around in the system, and sort of how insecure the system has gotten. A couple more stories, an interesting one up at the top of Top Picks at the blog. One of the investment newsletters reports that a surprising number of people are still concerned about the economy, and so are really sidelined, big cash positions in the market, and are not fully invested. That describes the wealthy. There was a little video that ran around the internet that I didn't post because it had so many four-letter words in it, but it was of a guy sitting in his attic, basically busting up Chinese goods with his baseball bat, and screaming about how the green shoots and talk of a recovery is all nonsense. It's about a 10-minute long thing, and interestingly enough, if you look at all of his comments about why the green shoots is a bunch of hooey, in fact he makes some very good points. We have every indicator of really basic activity in the economy is dropping, some dropping very fast, railroad shipments down, trucking tonnage down, the Baltic Dry Index has turned down again. Now, part of this is summer. Summer is a quieter time. So summer is a time of vacation. Summer is a time that people go to the beach. But if you look at all the fundamentals in the economy, what's happening in agriculture, what's happening in dry goods, we're seeing a real slowness. And in fact, despite all the talk of recovery and green shoots, the banks are flush and there may be some money for corporations. But if you look at most people around the world, I mean, in North America, we're better off than in many places. The pain is very real. And so the system continues to slow burn on, but in different pockets in the population, we're getting, you know, it might as well be meltdown if you've lost your job and your unemployment benefits have run out. So real pain in the economy, and that's why the state and local story is such an important one. So let me turn now one other thing I wanted to touch on. And this is sort of the ultimate multiple personality disorder. The Buckingham Palace announced that the Queen is doing a vegetable garden. And this is about, I guess it's about 1 or 2 months after the big announcement that Michelle Obama is doing an organic garden at the White House. So we literally have the multiple personality disorder of big pushes in Congress, big pushes in a variety of places, big Vatican report on this topic that I published in the blog last week, big push to promote genetically modified food, control the food system, make life more difficult for small farmers, and that includes even sort of amateur gardens and people sort of doing chickens in their backyard, especially with the National Animal Identification System. So on one hand, we're making it much more difficult for people to build local food supplies. On the other hand, the icons of the White House and Buckingham Palace are promoting, you know, today's equivalent of Victory Garden, and you look at it and you shake your head. Anyway, so Buckingham Palace has a vegetable garden. Okay, ask Catherine some great questions. One of the questions was about Social Security payments. Boomers are turning 62, but the Social Security system doesn't seem prepared to make payments to so many of us. When the FIC payments come in, the government uses that money and issues a bond to pay it back. I am 62 and intend to work until 70 at least, but if Social Security dissolves, .. As a practical matter, I assume for my own personal planning that I can't count on Social Security and I can't count on Medicare and Medicaid. Now, whether or not they exist is going to be a political matter. When you look through all the different things we talk about, we do not have an economic problem on this globe. If you look at the land and resources we have and the technology we have, including the technology that has not yet moved out of the laboratory, the closet, with the right kind of governance systems and cultural systems and asset management systems, there is no reason for people to live in what we have. I put up in the blog last week, $1.4 trillion of military expenditures globally. I mean, that's nuts. So we have the resources so that we can have a reasonably safe and decent life, certainly in North America. Will it happen is a political question. And if you look at where this thing is going, as we centralize the economy, certainly here we shrink it. As we've reinvested in the emerging markets, they've improved. But in this global crisis, it is in many places going the other way. So where this comes out has much more to do with politics than it has to do with economics. And I, for one, do not want to be emotionally or mentally dependent or financially dependent on the Social Security system because I don't trust the people who control and run it. If you look at the projections of when the system might go to negative cash flow, all of those projections assume that the dollar remains strong, and I don't think that that will necessarily happen. What we're asking people around the world and and particularly the other people in North America, particularly in Mexico, to work hard to support us and subsidize us. And that's a very unstable place to be. And so anything that we can do to start to think through what we would do to not be dependent on the Social Security system is a good thing to do. Now, what that means is if you can envision working for a longer time, if you can envision having and maintaining a lower overhead, all of those things are good. And having a backup plan, as if you are dependent on Social Security, what happens if the purchasing power is diluted, or if we should get a scenario where it goes away. I think the bigger chance is that the purchasing power gets diluted. So I would encourage you to start planning that way because it is a system which is dependent right now on a political system that depends on force. And that system is becoming more and more bankrupt. One of the questions I got was, what is the name and website of the vitamin company you trust? This is way outside of my area of expertise. Some of you heard the Solari report we did with Dr. Laura Thompson, who's my nutritionist. And what I do is I take almost all my guidance on vitamins and supplements from her, partly because I find that it needs to change over time. And so I really look to somebody that I trust to sort of help me with different names and brands. The multiple vitamin that I use in stockpile is Biotics Research multiple vitamin. It's their large multiple. It's Biotics Research. And one of the reasons I use them is I have an Ion's Clean machine. It's one of these foot bath machines, and the manufacturer recommends very strong multiple vitamins, and that's they had recommended Biotics Research. And it's one that I've checked with Laura, which she said was fine. So that's my I bet you the questionnaire was referring to my stockpile story. Next question, Woody Tash. The book Slow Money by Woody Tash sounds interesting. Do you know anything about it? Perhaps he could be a guest on one of the calls. Great question. If you go to the blog, there's a blog post called Material Omissions Part 1 and Material Omissions Part 2. And I tell a story about David Corton, who is a very popular author who writes about localization, and sort of an incident I had with David Corton. And I bring up that story because for many, many years, I've tried to come together and work with a variety of different networks and then pulled apart. And these networks are either involved with socially responsible investment like Woody Tash or like David Corton involved with localization. And if you look at some of the things I recommend, we share a lot of recommendations and interest. But there's one fundamental difference, and that is I believe it's very important to look at and understand the real risks in the economy. If you understand who's centralizing the system and how they're doing it, so if we're in a game of economic warfare, who's on the pro-centralization team and who's on the pro-decentralization team? In the Material Omissions blog post about David Corton, basically my experience was he's very much on the other team and is not interested in illuminating what's really going on. It's interesting. Somebody had sent him one of my articles, The Myth of the Rule of Law, and he wrote me a long email and said, oh, my God, I didn't know it was possible to tell the truth about these things and stay alive. And I wrote back and I said, well, yes, it's very possible to tell the truth about these things and stay alive. You just have to follow certain protocols, you know. So I gave him my theory of how to tell the truth, but do it in a way that doesn't inspire expensive opposition. And what I realized after I sent off the email is, well, what does that say about his books? because he's encouraging people to believe a framework of the problem and solution that leaves out this whole world of what's really going on and what the real risks are. Now, where I come from, to tell somebody, here's what's going on and here's what you need to do about it, and leave out a whole bunch of what the important truth is, you know, that's called a material omission, and that is a criminal offense in the securities world. If I get you to invest your time and money based on a false map of the world, then that's a L-I-E lie, and I can go to prison for that, you know, or at least when I was on Wall Street, I thought I could go to prison for that. And so what I've found with a whole world of wonderful people is they stay away from looking at the real deal. And when I read Woody's book, I've read Slow Money, it's a lovely book. It's got some great stuff in it. And he and his group do great things. And it would be great to have him on the Solari Report, so I thank you for that suggestion. What I've been doing is waiting for a time when that world is much more comfortable to deal with the real deal. And the one of the positive things of the bailouts and what is now going on is it is much easier now when I meet with and engage with those people to talk about what's really going on and what do we do about it. So as the environment changes, the discussions that I need to have to protect people's money in the real world become much more socially acceptable to folks in that world. So that was a great suggestion, and I will see about getting Woody and people in that group on. Finally, a question about what is volatility? And the question came in the context of how money travels through an economy and what it means if the money has a high velocity versus a low velocity. I saw, and I think I put a link to it up on the blog, a great little video up on YouTube. Somebody checks into a hotel, I think it was in France, it was in Europe. So they check into the hotel and they pay 100 francs. And they go up to their room and the hotel owed a local supplier, so let's say it was a plumber, the 100 francs, they pay the plumber. He jumps on his bike and rides over to somebody that he owes the money to, then they pay somebody else, and then that somebody pays somebody who owes the hotel 100 francs. They pay the hotel back their money, and then the person who had reserved the room comes back down. They don't like the room. They change their mind. They're leaving. They want their 100 francs back. They get their 100 francs, and they leave. But in the meantime, that money has ripped around the local economy, and four or five people have extinguished their debt. It's a beautiful example of the multiplier that can happen in an economy. And one of the reasons I so love liquidity systems and markets where they work is you can take a little bit of resources and by people trading and transacting and investing and passing them around in productive and economic ways, you know, you can get tremendous wealth going with just a little bit. It's a little bit like the old stone soup story, if you know that story. So the velocity in an economy is it's related to the concept of, you'll hear the word use, multiplier. If I come into town and pay the hotel 100 francs for my hotel room, what happens to that money? Does the hotel owner say, times are bad, the banks aren't lending, I need to save this money and not pay back the vendor that I owe the money to, and he just sits on it? Or does he say, no, let me pay the plumber on time, and the plumber say, let me buy something for my wife, and then the flower store where he buys flowers, does he say, am I going to hoard this because times are tough, or am I going to invest it? How about if I take it over to the local bank and put the money, see if I can get a CD? And so velocity and multipliers are about the speed at which money turns around and turns over into the economy. Think of it as a high turnover in the money. What we're seeing in the economy, when I talked about the banks not lending, is you have the Fed or Treasury providing tremendous resources to the large banks, but that money has no velocity through the economy. And in fact, if the reports we're hearing are coming down from corporate headquarters and the regulators saying, don't lend, then in fact what that's doing is that's slowing down the multiplier, it's slowing down the velocity. Now, if you look at the money supply in an economy, very simply, it's how much money gets issued or printed, and then how great the multiplier and the velocity is. One of the issues you'll see a lot when people talk about when they talk about a local economy, as we have more and more big corporations, franchises, big box stores, somebody spends a dollar, but it leaves. It doesn't slow down, and it doesn't go around the economy. It doesn't multiply in that way. And one of the things that Woody Tash's book, Slow Money, is about is how do we slow the money down so it keeps multiplying many times throughout the economy. So one of the things we're seeing is we're seeing people hoarding money, not acting, not investing, not transacting. Part of that is just taking up the savings rate. And so we're really seeing the velocity of money slow down and the multiplier shrink. And that's part of the deflationary effect that seems to be offsetting this inflation and stopping these predictions coming true of many people have expected a hyperinflation. It hasn't happened yet because we're seeing so much slowdown on the other side. So great questions this week. That's it for Ask Catherine. So let's turn to California. Now, California, in 2004, there was a very big budget problem in California. In fact, at that time, the announcements were that the budget deficit was $38 billion. Now, today we're looking at a budget deficit of $24 billion and, with a dollar worth less. So that's nowhere near as significant as it was in 2004. And some of you have heard me tell this story before. I was driving up to Washington for a meeting, and I stopped in. I was staying at the home of Kelly O'Meara, who is a reporter who's done tremendously great work on a variety of topics, but one of them is the missing money. And I said to her, it was funny, what happened was, that the week before, the $38 billion was a big, big issue in California, and then suddenly all public pronouncements about the California deficit and other state and local deficit stopped. And I got up to Washington and I said, Kelly, I don't understand it. Suddenly all these state deficits have gone away. California's not worried now about a $38 billion deficit. What happened? And Kelly said the Iraq war happened, they've passed enough wartime appropriations, and I think they're providing money through the back door to the state and local governments, and that's how they're plugging the deficit. Now, when she said that, my jaw dropped. I couldn't fathom that the lines between federal, state, and local had blurred to that extent that you could just provide, billions of dollars of bailout under the table and without any bailout bill or law or discussion. But something happened, and I can't tell you ultimately what it was, but suddenly those deficits went away, and the only logical hypothesis I can come up with was that there was a backdoor bailout. Now, I bring this story up for two reasons. One is, interestingly enough, we just passed Congress just passed $106 billion war funding for Iraq. And you look at that and you wonder, oh, my God, is there money hidden in there for state and local government bailouts? That's one reason. The second reason is I don't know what's going to happen in California on July 1st. The budget has to be done by June 30, although theoretically they can have continuing resolutions and keep the debate and discussion going on a little bit longer. But one of the things I've noticed in a lot of California citizens who I know, people I know who've lived through the 2004 budget crisis, there's sort of a feeling of not being concerned, as though, you know, the politicians will get together and figure this out and take care of it, just like they have in prior budget crises and prior times. And the reality is I've always been stunned at how many times the rabbit has gotten pulled out of the hat to keep the slow burn going. And so I don't know that it can't be pulled out of the hat this time. And, you know, including whether or not money will come backdoor from the federal government to keep them going. There are many ways they can do it. But it might. The reason why I think it is very useful, if you are a citizen of California, to assume this time that it might not, is twofold. There is a lot of money amassed. The banks have bailed out. They are cutting back on lending. There's a lot of signs that they're now ready to buy assets and buy them cheap. And if we are in that scenario, then it will work to the benefit of those who govern the federal government to have the state and local budgets cut back and cut back big. And I'm going to talk more about it as we go through it. That's number one. Number two, if you look at the things we need to do to be prepared for big cutbacks this summer or continued drop in economic activity, we need to do those things for the long run anyway. So the things we would do to prepare for trouble in California or trouble in our state government and serious state and local cutbacks, these are things we need to do because of how the economy is going in the long run anyway. So I think it is prudent to really consider that the worst case might happen here, and we could get sizable cuts in the budget and sizable policy changes. We had the Sacramento Bee about a week ago publish an article saying that one of the debates in the state house was seriously considering just canceling welfare. Now that would have an unbelievable impact on life and the economy in California. So could that happen? I don't know. But I think it is prudent to start planning to deal with those kinds of changes. Now, let me just say a few words. If you're the governor of California, there are many things you can do to help the economy which are not politically acceptable to the federal government and what I call the pro-centralization team. And one way to look through the policy options that you have at a state or local level is to consider, on one hand, we are incredibly dependent on the central government. So if you look at, we posted a whole set of links on the blog in Shock Doctrine California Part 2, that if you're interested in looking at sort of the fundamental economics of California, you can use those links and start to sort of look up the financial information. There's one great website called Eagle Eye, and you can take a look at the federal grants and contracts flowing into California. What you will see is the California economy, just like many other economies, or really all state economies at this point in the United States, are very dependent on defense contracts, military spending, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. If tomorrow California woke up and said, okay, nobody's going to send tax money to the United States government, we're just going to keep the money we pay for federal taxes back here, then those would be tremendous resources that California could use in California. The problem is California is getting tremendous subsidy from the federal system, not the least of which comes from the dollar being the reserve currency and being subsidized worldwide, and the military being active and holding that up, and those military operations and expenditures being critical to the California economy and, believe it or not, the California university system. You have many, many big universities throughout the country, including in California, which is very dependent on federal contracts and federal flows. So if you're the governor, one of the things you can do is you can issue a currency. I posted up on the blog the experience of the Guernsey Island, who issued their own currency to do local state expenditures. When states have gotten into financial problems, we'll see them sometimes issue script. That could happen in a California situation. So whether it's issue script, issue their own currency, create their own bank, these are steps they could take. The problem is if they take those, they buck the central system. Another thing they could do is they could re-engineer how state and local money are spent. And the first thing they could do, and one of the incredible expenses in any state and local government, is the cost of federal laws and rules. Tremendous regulatory requirements that require state and local government to spend money and do things in a certain way. If state and local government were free of those expenses, there's tremendous reengineering that could occur. Again, will the federal government permit that? Because the more you permit that, the less central control you have. Finally, there's a great deal they could do in California. California has very rich cash and financial reserves, big pension funds, big state and local government agencies with rich reserves. Where is that money deposited? What banks? Where is it invested? If those funds were shifted to banking locally, investing locally, doing more local, very big shift. But again, that's not what the sort of centralization team wants, and there are very serious political issues there. So there are many, many things that could happen in terms of fundamental change to stop the drain in the system, because, again, a lot of the things draining California are what's draining most communities, and that is you can't afford big government and big corporations. You can't afford them in a way that really reduces the health of the fundamental economy. So you can't bring narcotics trafficking and mortgage fraud into a community and lots of control and regulation and think the economy is going to stay healthy. So you've got to either change that, or now the problem with changing that is that centralized system needs that subsidy, and what they offer in exchange is the promise of all these programs and benefits, which they can finance as long as the dollar is high and is functioning as the reserve currency. So you have a vicious dependency on the centralized system, and what all of us can do is to start to do what we can to withdraw and move away. Now, the first thing you can do, because it really comes down to what you can do in your life and in your household, and it very much depends on where you are. But one of the things you can do is start to learn about how your community works. There's wide variation in this country, a lot of it depending on whether you live in the city or suburbs or rural areas. If you come to a town like the one I live in, Hickory Valley, Tennessee, what you'll find is extraordinary literacy among a surprising number of the population about how all the state and local systems work in their area, and if they want to communicate or find out information, they know who and where to go. And there's a lot of process that allows them access. If you spend any time in New Zealand, you'll find the same thing. Much more literacy about how the systems around them work and how they can communicate and affect change. In many American cities and suburbs, there's surprisingly little knowledge about who's who and how to relate to the different municipal systems. Because one thing, if we know how the systems within our county or our town work, then we can start to take steps to communicate. For example, one of the things we've seen in many areas of the world when you start to get significant government cutbacks in services is there are real safety issues. And there is a real need for greater communication between the community and the local sheriff or the police force. So this is a time to not only know your banker and know your farmer, but start to get to know your local municipal officials and find ways of communicating with them which are energizing for you. Oftentimes there are different kinds of community forums. One of the most time-effective ways of doing this is if you can identify your state or local representative and their people that you know and trust. Sometimes neighborhoods have neighborhood councils and representatives. This is a time to know some of those people and to find out what you can do to be supportive of their efforts, because good communication is going to be important. And the more we can support and lift up sort of the good guys in the system, the better off we are. Okay, step number two, I keep banging the drum about finding your local food systems. Where is your local farmer? Where is the community-supported agriculture? Where are the farmers markets? Where are the groups who are buying food wholesale? Where are the people organizing to create a safe, secure food system? But what you want to think about is very practically food, water, energy, safety. If the economy takes another cycle down as a result of big state and local cutbacks, because the state cutback is going to cycle into the local cutbacks as sure as anything. So what you want to focus on in very, very practical ways, you've heard me talk about the importance of stockpiling. Stockpiling is not just a matter of buying it today before the price goes up, but it's also of having plenty of inventory of the things you need if there should be shortages. Because if we get a real cycle down in the economy this summer or this fall, which could happen with real serious cutbacks, you really need to have provision, and you need to have extra provision. The third thing is find allies. Many of us have lived a life of, you know, when I lived in Washington or New York, I really didn't know my neighbors. Not only did I not understand how my community worked, but I really didn't know my neighbors, and I really didn't have people who could help me make the changes that are upon us. And again, you know, if the budget crisis turns out not to be bad, we're going to make the changes slow. But the changes are upon us because the economy is changing. Do everything, you know, I keep saying organize a circle. Get a group of people together for a dinner group. Do a potluck dinner. Watch DVDs. Listen to the Solari Report. Talk about what is going on and how you can help each other deal with it. This is a time when you do not want to be alone, and you don't want to have to figure everything out yourself. So see if you can't find allies and start to create help groups, particularly in your neighborhood, is where it would be wonderful. I'm not tonight going to go through all the items in Position Your Assets for Growth, our audio seminar. And we've gone through it before. We did a Solari report on what to do with your cash. But again, lower your overhead, simplify. If you have the resources, good time to pay down your debt, stockpile. Franklin and I talked last Solari report about the possibility of getting some drops this summer in the price of precious metals. If it is, it's a good time to buy. Precious metals can provide an alternative currency. In the worst case, it's not without risk, as we've talked before. Finally, if you are someone who has investments in municipal bonds, the state and local budget crisis is going to affect the price of those municipal bonds and the credit value of those municipal bonds, both at the state and local level. So So one of the things you need to be thinking about is, what is the impact of this on my municipal bond portfolio, and do I need to make adjustments accordingly? Okay, let me talk also about some of the emotional issues involved. I had a very unusual guy who was, believe it or not, had been in very senior covert operations in the one of the intelligence agencies. And when I was at the worst part of the litigation, by sort of an odd set of circumstances, I got to know this fellow. And he gave me one of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten in my life. He said, you know, when this kind of change happens, and it can be a very disturbing change, and it can even be at times a very scary change, he said, what you need to do is you need to understand it's like a wave, and you just need to let it roll over you. Now, let me explain what he meant by that. When we get into, we've all lived, if you're an American, we've lived in a situation where we've had the good life. And the possibility is increasing that we're going to go through periods of either gut-wrenching change for us or watching the people around us go through gut-wrenching change. And it is very easy in those kinds of circumstances to feel overwhelmed. And what he was advising me to do was to understand that when I start to feel overwhelmed, to just let it pass over. And one of the things I learned for many years, because I can't tell you all how many hopeless situations I was in. There were many, many times when I was sure that I would not be alive in the morning. And one of the things I learned was to simply let go about worrying about things, stay in a state of amusement, and let the wave roll over. And what I discovered is if I could do that, that over time solutions would emerge that were not apparent. And so it was very, very important to let the wave roll over. The second thing that was very important, in 1998, I said to myself, you know, your situation is so dire that you may not live. And it was kind of a chilling moment. And I sat down and I said, okay, I'm going to study the history of people who've been in this situation before. And then I'm going to figure out what worked and what didn't work. And I'm going to try and learn from that and figure out how I can get out of this alive. And so I did. I went back and I looked at different people who'd been through this kind of sort of traumatic change. And dealing with a leadership, if you will, who were doing really evil things. I really felt that what was happening in the sort of the fraudulent inducement of America and the housing bubble and the related sort of organized crime activities, the mortgage fraud, was really genocide. And I was just appalled at what was going on. So what I found was the people who had not made it had literally not made it because of their own anger. Their own anger had made them ineffective. Their own anger had made them, it had made them sick. You know, it had caused health problems. And what I realized was I needed to take a completely spiritual approach to the whole process and say basically, I'm a great believer that the way to get power over a situation is to take responsibility. So it was to say, it is what it is. This is happening for a good reason. It has a happy ending. And I'm going to find a way for all of this to work to my advantage. One of the things I've mentioned many times is I found a great church that was really expert on spiritual warfare. I've said before the African American churches have lived through the war on terrorism. It was called the war on drugs. They've lived through being targeted, lied about, you know, just horrible sort of economic warfare experiences and I believe real genocide, and they've developed amazing tools for dealing through very, very difficult and hard times. One of the things that helped me was, and I think can help everyone in California, because knowledge is power. Many places in the world have lived through dramatic downturns in their economy, you know, particularly in the 90s, and including being the target of economic warfare. I had Dmitry Orlov, who talked about Russia. We had Cliff High talk about his WebBot program and what it says. I called my blog post this week Shock Doctrine California because I think if you have the time to read Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, it's a wonderful description of how this kind of economic game comes down. And my question on what's going to happen in California is not, is Shock Doctrine going to happen? It's happening now. My question is it going to be nice or rough? And one of the things that can help you if you live in California is seeing the game, because it looks like all sorts of people are going to show up and their job is to help the economy and fix it, just like the regulatory package we talked about at the federal level. And that's not what the goal of those efforts, the goal of that effort is the concentration and control of cash and equity investment in the area. Now, let me give you an example. One of the things that got posted on the I posted on the blog was a comment that somebody gave from an editor in the Marin paper newspaper. I believe it was yesterday. Said the general fund budget for our state parks, already cut to the bone, accounts for less than 0.1% of the state budget. Yet for every dollar that funds the parks, $2.35 is returned to the state's general fund through economic activities in all the surrounding communities. With more than 80 million visitors to our state parks last year alone, eliminating funding for the parks would result in the state losing over $350 million in related revenue. Economic downturn is not an acceptable reason before we squander our state's priceless resources, already paid for by our tax dollars. We should look at less destructive ways to economize. Now, what that writer is assuming is that the goal of the budgeting process is to optimize revenues to the state or the well-being of the total economy. And the reality is, when you're in a situation like this, that's not true. We're in a political economy. Oftentimes, the goal of the process is to optimize the amount of financial activity going through the insider's channel. So is that money, is that asset on a corporate balance sheet? Is that market share going through the right company's financial statements? You know, is that money in the small businesses, or is that money in the big box store? And in fact, what we're going to see all over the country is the development community moving into the political process, and whether it's the state or local parks, saying, you know, on any valuable land, let's privatize that land and let's do it at distressed prices. And let's do it in a construct where state and local revenues will be used to develop that land on a private basis. You know, don't be surprised if it comes in under the context of let's do this green. So one of the things you want to think about is, if there are groups who can lead this or people who can lead this in your community, what are the assets that are in play, like the state parks, and how do you protect them from that development process? Some of them will not be able to be protected. We saw an article in that I posted up on the blog with discussion in California of San Quentin being moved, and the land under San Quentin, which is incredibly valuable, being privatized or put in the development process. The reality is you can't afford to have a prison on land that's become that valuable in this environment. So we're going to see changes, but one of the things to think about, if there's the leadership locally to do it, is how can we transform those changes so that local governance and control of those assets is asserted. And I'll talk about that more in future Solarium reports. Finally, just let me mention quickly, if anger is your enemy, imagination is your friend. There's no way that we as a society could continue the way we were going. We need to change. The reality is we don't like to change unless we have to. And so in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. So as you start to see this change, look for ways, and this is where we use our imagination, look for ways that we can start to have conversations of, okay, we've been centralizing the economy. How do we build community here, and how do we take advantage of this realization that we have to change and use it to our benefit, use it to really transform things? Because the possibility is there to have lots of conversations. There'll be lots of conversations going on in this fall in California that were not possible a year ago. So if you're in California, you need to pay attention. This is something that could impact you even dramatically. And now's the time to start shifting how you use your time and money to really both protect you and your family and what's going to happen and take advantage of what's going to happen. Now, I've gone over, so I'm only going to speak very briefly about our movie. Let's Welcome to Mooseport. Welcome to Mooseport is I think it's very funny. It certainly didn't go to the top of the charts. Gene Hackman is the retiring president of the United States. He retires and moves to Mooseport, Maine, and gets sort of tricked into running for mayor against a guy who's the owner of the local hardware store. And it's a beautiful example of someone who's used to dealing with very global issues, with dealing with people who are used to dealing with very local issues. And I laugh because it reminds me when I first moved to Hickory Valley, Tennessee, for the last two decades, you know, the average size of the deal I had done, you know, I was leading deals that were $500 million to $1 billion transactions. You know, and then the first week I walk into Hickory Valley, go to the Hickory Valley Women's Club and spend an hour with a group of people who are debating whether we should spend an extra quarter to do something for the fish fry. Well, I almost went nuts. And it's the same dynamic you see in Welcome to Mooseport. You see a world that's used to optimizing bottom up, trying to deal with a world that's optimizing top down. And of course, what you get by the end of the movie is sort of this, well, you know, we need both. And one of the things that's going to happen to almost every person listening to the Solari Report is we're all going to go through a process. If you're a person who's used to, you know, sort of dealing bottom up, or you're a person who's used to dealing top down, we're going to go through a process where we're going to have to get more balance. We're going to have to get good at dealing with the other. So think of it this way. If you're a wholesale person, you're going to have to start learning retail. If you're a retail person, you're going to have to start learning wholesale. So we've had our knowledge organized into different pockets, and usually we're good at one, if not both, in this society. And what's going to happen in many communities as these state and budget crises roll out this year and next year, it could translate into the following year, is Welcome to Mooseport is going to play out in our lives and in our communities again and again and again. So it's worth looking at that movie. I think it's unbelievably funny, but then I love Gene Hackman. And it's worth watching Welcome to Mooseport, and whether you relate more to the hardware store owner, you relate more to the president, think about, okay, how can we start to improve our communications between the people who are used to functioning nationally and globally and the people who are used to functioning locally? Because if the two groups can start to give each other energy, then this transformation is going to go much better, much faster. It's a great opportunity if you can get people in both groups really working together and helping each other. So that's it for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, July 2nd, we're going to have our second quarter wrap-up. I do a year-end wrap-up. I like to do a wrap-up that sort of says, here's how we're doing, you know, up against sort of the key issues that I look at, really the opportunity and risk areas. I'm going to comment on the Canadian TV series Intelligence. It's available on DVD, and if you like, you know, it's not just one show. It's a whole series. If you like those kinds of series, it has great insight on how government works right now. It's set in Vancouver, so it's Canadian, but it's one I think is very insightful about the real deal on government, particularly as it relates to organized crime and the economy. It's really a comment on how government, big government, and the economy work. So, second quarter wrap up, July 2nd, and then the Canadian TV series Intelligence. The following week we have the Precious Metals update. July is going to be a very important month for Precious Metals. So a lot to talk about then. Anyway, please remember, again, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. And if you're in California, you really need to start one. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.